Okay, I want you to start by putting yourself in a very specific, very uncomfortable place. It's loud, it's hot, it is violent. Imagine you are standing inside a massive industrial chute in a mineral processing plant. Or maybe you're staring into the teeth of a giant crusher in a mine.
It's a brutal environment. I mean, you have tons of jagged rock, silica sand, all these abrasive minerals just smashing against steel surfaces every single second. In the industry, we call that three-body abrasion.
Right, because it's not just two smooth things rubbing together. It's the machine, the rock, and then all the grit caught in between.
Yeah, it's like jagged sandpaper.
Exactly. Now, standard steel can handle that for a while. But today, we are turning the difficulty setting up to nightmare mode. Imagine that same crushing, grinding environment, but the temperature is cranked up to 1,000 degrees Celsius.
And that changes the game completely. At that temperature, mechanical wear, the squatching and bashing, that's only half the problem. The real killer is oxidation. Most metals don't just get soft when they get that hot. They literally burn. They react with oxygen and just crumble away.
It's like wearing a suit of armor into a volcano while someone takes a belt sander to your face. It seems impossible. So, how do we keep these machines running? That is the topic of today's deep dive. We are looking at industrial armor, specifically a process called hard facing.
Hard facing is a fascinating corner of engineering, really, because it is so practical. It's the art of welding a sacrificial skin, a super tough alloy, onto a cheaper, softer base metal.
So you let the skin take the beating so the expensive machine part doesn't have to.
Exactly.
And usually that works fine. But the sources we're looking at today pose a specific, really difficult question. What happens when you need that armor to survive not just the smashing, but also that extreme heat? We're breaking down a study titled ECRC Hard-Facing Alloys for High-Temperature Applications by Elie Svensson and his colleagues.
This paper is essentially a detective story. It looks at a specific alloy that somehow manages to survive that 1,000-degree nightmare we just described. But the twist, and this is why I love material science, is that the metal survives not because it was designed perfectly according to the textbook, but because of a happy accident of
Well, a
physics.
happy accident. I love those. It sounds like we're about to discover the penicillin of heavy industry. So our mission today is to unpack that accident. We need to figure out how a specific mix of iron, chromium, and carbon manages to cheat death. Let's get into the kitchen. What is the recipe for this stuff?
The alloy in question is designated technically as F34Cr4.5C.
Okay, let's translate that from chemist to English. Fe is iron, that's the base. But those numbers seem aggressive.
Oh, they are. They're massive numbers for an alloy. You have roughly 34% chromium and 4.5% carbon by weight.
Contextualize that for me. If I go to my kitchen and pick up a stainless steel knife, what am I holding?
A standard stainless steel knife might have 12% to maybe 18% chromium and barely any carbon, usually way, way less than 1%.
So this alloy has double the chromium and four or five times the carbon of a standard tool steel. That sounds less like steel and more like, well, a ceramic that's pretending to be metal.
It's not far off.
Right.
4.5% carbon is incredibly high. When you mix that much carbon with iron and chromium, it doesn't just dissolve nicely into the metal like, sugar in tea. It reacts. It forms carbides.
And we're going to spend a lot of time on these carbides. In the notes, I've got them listed as the muscle of the operation.
Exactly. These are hard hexagonal crystals. Specifically, they're chromium carbides known as M7C3. And in the study, they measured the hardness of these crystals at 1200 to 1600 Vickers.
Vickers, that's the hardness scale. Give us a benchmark so we know how impressive that is.
Okay, so standard structural steel, the stuff beams are made of, is usually around 200 Vickers.
Wow.
So these crystals are 6 to 8 times harder than the steel they're protecting. They're like industrial diamonds embedded in the metal.
Okay, so we have this super hard alloy, but you can't just cast a whole machine part out of this, can you?
No, absolutely not. It would be insanely expensive and frankly too brittle. If you made a whole crusher tooth out of this, it might shatter on the first impact like glass. That is why we use hard facing. We weld it onto the surface of a tougher, cheaper metal.
And the study mentions they use manual metal arc welding, and they're very specific about the technique. They lay it down in three layers. Why three? Why not just one thick coat and call it a day?
It comes down to purity. When you weld that first layer, you are melting the hard-facing rod, but you're also melting the surface of the base metal underneath. They mix together in a molten pool.
Right, you're watering down your drink.
Exactly. We call it dilution. The soft steel from the machine gets into your hard armor and weakens it. By the time you weld the second layer, you're welding on top of that first layer, so it's purer. By the third layer, you have the full, undiluted chemical composition you paid for.
But the study also says they stop at three layers. They don't go to four or five. Why not just make it thicker?
That is the other edge of the sword.
Yeah.
This material is so hard and has such a different thermal expansion rate than the base metal that if you build it up too thick, the internal stresses just get too high. It will rip itself apart as it cools. You get extensive cracking. So three layers is the Goldilocks zone.
Okay, so we've welded this three-layer cake onto our machine. Now, I want to zoom in. The researchers in the study didn't just look at the surface. They sliced it open and put it under some heavy-duty microscopes. What does this stuff actually look like?
Imagine a concrete wall.
Ah.
In concrete, you have the big rocks, the aggregate, and you have the cement paste that holds them together. This alloy is a composite, just like concrete.
So the rocks are those carbides we mentioned.
Yes. Under the microscope, you see these massive hexagonal islands. Those are the primary carbides. They are the first things to freeze out of the liquid melt. They are the shield that breaks the rocks hitting the machine.
And the cement?
The cement is the matrix. In this specific alloy, the matrix is a phase of iron called austenite, or gamma iron.
Right.
It's softer, it's tougher, and its job is to hold those hard carbide crystals in place so they don't just pop out when they get hit.
So we have the muscle, the carbides, and the binder, the austenite. It sounds like a perfect team, but I feel like you're about to introduce a problem.
The problem is the heat. Remember, we aren't just grinding rocks. We are doing it at 1,000 degrees Celsius. And to survive that heat without rusting away, you need chromium.
Chromium is the stuff that makes stainless steel. Stainless.
Correct. Chromium reacts with oxygen to form a very thin, very tough skin called chromium oxide. That skin seals the metal off. If you don't have enough chromium, that skin doesn't form and the metal burns.
Okay, I see where this is going. We put 34% chromium into the pot. That seems like plenty.
It should be. But here's the conflict, the civil war inside the alloy. We also put in a ton of carbon to make those hard carbides. And what are the carbides made of?
Chromium and carbon.
Exactly. The carbides are greedy. As they form in the liquid metal, they act like sponges. They just suck up huge amounts of chromium from the surrounding mixture to build their crystal structures.
So the question isn't, how much chromium did we put in? The question is,
how much chromium is left?
How much is left for the matrix after the carbides are done eating?
Precisely. It's a resource war. If the carbides steal all the chromium, the matrix, the binder is left starved. It becomes lean. And a lean matrix has no protection against the heat. The binder will burn away, the hard carbides will fall out, and your armor fails.
So Svensson and his team needed to find out exactly how much chromium was left in that binder. But this isn't something you can just eyeball.
No.
Yeah.
Not at all. They had to use transmissional electron microscopy, TEM, and scanning electron microscopy, SEM. We're talking about shooting beams of electrons at the atomic structure to see what is there.
And this is where they hit a snag that I found really interesting. It's a technical glitch involving the invisible man of the periodic table carbon.
This is a great detail for the tech-savvy listeners. When you use NSEM, you are often using a technique called EDS, energy dispersive X-ray spectroscopy. Basically, you hit the atoms with electrons, and the atoms shoot X-rays back at you. The energy of the X-ray tells you what element it is.
Simple enough, so why couldn't they see the carbon?
Because of the window on the detector. The sensor is protected by a beryllium window. And beryllium is a metal that lets most X-rays through, but it absorbs the weak, low-energy X-rays.
From the light elements?
From the light elements. And carbon is a very light element.
So the carbon X-rays were hitting the window and just getting stopped before they could be counted. The machine was blind to the carbon.
Effectively, yes. So they had a map of the iron and the chromium, but a blind spot for carbon. They had to use math to fill in the blanks. The paper lists these complex equations where they calculate the true concentration, the Xi based on the raw readings, the Yi, and correct for the invisible carbon.
It's wild that even with million-dollar microscopes, you still need algebra to see the full picture. So after they crunch the numbers and correct for the blind spot, what did they see in the microstructure?
They saw a landscape. You had those big blocky primary carbide islands we talked about. But surrounding them, they saw something beautiful called a eutectic mixture.
Eutectic.
Yeah.
That is a word that scares people. Break it down for us.
Think of it as a synchronized dance. As the remaining liquid metal cools, it reaches a point where it can't hold any more carbon or iron in solution. So it splits. It splits into two solids at the exact same time. You get tiny little carbides and the austenite binder growing together, intermingled.
The description in the text made it sound like a maze or a fingerprint.
That's a good visual. The fine, intricate structure. But they noticed something else. Right next to the big, blocky islands, there was a gap, a moat, where there were no tiny carbides. They called it the precipitate free zone.
Why a moat? Why didn't the maze go all the way to the castle walls?
Because the big island was too greedy. As it grew, it sucked all the carbon and chromium out of the liquid immediately surrounding it. So when the rest of the liquid froze, that little rim, it didn't have enough ingredients to make new carbides.
It depleted the soil around it. Okay, so we have the map. Big carbide islands, a depleted moat, and then this fine eutectic maze. But let's go back to the million-dollar question. The binder. The austenite. Did it have enough chromium left to survive the volcano?
This brings us to the aha moment of the study. And to understand it, we have to talk about the difference between what nature wants to do and what nature actually does.
Equilibrium versus reality.
Exactly. In thermodynamics, equilibrium is the state where everything is balanced. It's the lowest energy state. It is where the atoms want to settle if you give them infinite time to move around.
So they looked at the textbook, the phase diagrams. If you cool this alloy down to 1150 degrees Celsius slowly and let it reach equilibrium, what should the chromium level in the binder be?
According to the theory, the carbides should have continued to grow and suck up chromium until the matrix was drained down to about 15.1% chromium.
15.1%. Okay, keep that number in mind. Now, what did Svensson actually find when he measured the real-world weld?
He found the matrix contained between 16.4% and 17% chromium.
So, reality be the theory. The matrix kept more chromium than it was supposed to. Why? Did the carbides just get full?
No, they didn't get full. They ran out of time. This is the crucial mechanism. Welding involves melting, but it also involves rapid cooling. The base metal acts like a massive heat sink, sucking the heat away instantly.
So the cooling rate is just incredibly fast.
So fast that the atoms simply didn't have time to diffuse.
They got caught speeding.
In a sense, yes. The paper uses the phrase configurationally frozen. The microstructure of the metal is essentially a snapshot of what the liquid looked like at a higher temperature.
So usually, as metal cools, the atoms would move around, the carbides would keep growing, keep eating up more chromium. But here, the temperature dropped so fast that the music stopped and everyone had to freeze where they were.
Exactly. The matrix was trapped in a state of high chromium content before the carbides could finish their meal. This is called non-equilibrium solidification. This is the happy accident.
But does that 1% or 2% difference really matter? Is 17% that much better than 15%?
Oh, it matters immensely. It is the difference between life and death for the machine. To form that protective oxide layer at room temperature, you only need about 12% chromium. But the study notes that to sustain that protection at 1,000 degrees Celsius, you need roughly 17% chromium in the matrix.
There it is, the magic number.
If the alloy had cooled slowly, if it had reached that perfect equilibrium, the matrix would have dropped to 15%, and the part likely would have failed in high heat service. But because it was welded and cooled quickly, it got locked at 17%. That frozen state is the only reason this material works.
That is kind of terrifying, actually. It means the survival of this massive industrial equipment depends on a stopwatch. It depends on the history of the cooling rate.
It really highlights that materials science isn't just about chemistry. It's about time. You can have the exact same ingredients, but if you cook them at a different speed, you get a completely different material.
But this raises a huge red flag for me regarding stability. If this metal is frozen in a state that it doesn't naturally want to be in, doesn't it want to go back?
That is the catch.
Yeah.
You have identified the Achilles heel. The material is what we call metastable. It is not in its happy place. It is like a ball sitting in a small dip on the side of a hill. It's stable for now, but gravity wants it to roll all the way to the bottom.
And the bottom in this case means the chromium leaving the matrix and joining the carbides.
Exactly. If you leave this alloy at high heat, specifically above 700 degrees Celsius for a long time, nature will try to correct itself. The austenite could decompose. The carbides could grow.
Yeah.
And most dangerously, the chromium levels in the matrix could drop as it tries to reach that equilibrium of 15%.
Wait, we just said this material is designed for high temperature applications, but now you're saying the heat itself causes the armor to degrade. Isn't that a fatal flaw?
In theory, yes. But in practice, we are saved by something called sluggish kinetics.
Sluggish kinetics. That sounds like me before my first coffee.
It's not dissimilar. Even though the atoms want to move to the carbides, they have to physically travel through the solid metal. They have to diffuse. In this complex alloy, you have these large chromium atoms, carbon atoms, iron atoms. It's a crowded dance floor.
So the movement is slow.
Incredibly slow. For the microstructure to change significantly, it takes a long, long time. So it is a race. It's a race between the service life of the part and the diffusion speed of the atoms.
As long as the part wears out from the rocks before the atoms have time to rearrange themselves, we win.
Precisely. We are betting on the sluggishness of the atoms.
How does this compare to other materials? I know tungsten carbide is usually the go-to for really hard stuff. Why not just use that?
Tungsten carbide is harder than chromium carbide. At room temperature, it wins. But the source points out a major weakness. Tungsten carbide decarburizes rapidly in air above 500 degrees Celsius.
It breaks down.
Yeah, it turns into a soft oxide and loses its structural integrity. It essentially turns to dust. Chromium carbide, on the other hand, remains stable well beyond 1,000 degrees Celsius.
So tungsten is the sprinter, fast and powerful but burns out. This iron chromium carbon alloy is the marathon runner.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah.
It's a compromise. You trade a little bit of absolute hardness for the ability to exist inside a furnace.
And that compromise is only possible because we tricked the metal during the cooling process.
We tricked the metal. We froze the matrix before it could give away its protection.
So let's bring this all back to the surface. We started with a welding rod. We melted it onto a machine part in three distinct layers to manage dilution. We looked at it with an electron microscope using algebra to see the invisible carbon. And we found that the cooling rate trapped the chromium where we needed it most.
That is the summary. It is a frozen accident of physics that allows us to operate machinery in conditions that should be impossible for this grade of steel.
It makes you think about the concept of stability. We usually think stable is good. We want stable bridges, stable economies. But in material science, stable can mean useless.
Very often, the properties we desire, hardness, strength, toughness, come from non-equilibrium states. We are constantly fighting nature's desire to turn everything into a low-energy, soft, uniform mush.
We are fighting the mush.
We are fighting the mush. By freezing these structures, we are essentially pressing pause on a degradation process.
That is a provocative thought to leave you with. If this advanced alloy performs well only because it is frozen in the wrong state, how many other things in our world work the same way? Are we and our technologies just successfully pausing a process that will eventually win?
In the long run, equilibrium always wins. But our job as engineers is to make the long run longer than our lifetime.
On that existential note, thanks for joining us on this deep dive into the microscopic battleground of hard facing.
A pleasure to be here.
And to you, the listener, keep fighting the mush. We'll see you in the next deep dive.